every corner. I worked long hours, consulting widely, and put together a rescue plan for the business. And to cut a long story short, we began a turnaround for the company. And today, as far as I'm aware, it's doing well. At the completion of this intense activity, the chairman asked to speak with me. And these were his words. "Roger, we know the past few months have been extremely difficult for you, and we would like to thank you for all your hard work. But, bearing in mind all the changes, particularly in personnel, we don't believe it is in your interest to remain with the company." Well, as you can imagine, I was stunned. This can't be happening, I thought. This is a Christian company. At that moment, I knew precisely how Jesus must have felt when he received that kiss from Judas. Maybe something similar has happened to you. But to move north at that time would have meant the breakup of our family. It took me some time to realize that God sent me on a mission. Jean believes it was all part of God's plan. And of course, she was right. How is it you ladies are so much wiser than us men? The title of tonight's sermon is Christian Work Relationships. In conversation with the local vicar at a party, someone was overheard to say, "Vicar, yours must be a soul-destroying job." Think about it. One thing that struck me most forcibly over the past 5 years of training and actually trying to be a reader is the gulf that exists between the ideals of Scripture and living them in the real world. The peace and tranquility of a Sunday sermon is quickly disturbed by the standards of behaviour we find in the world. In the recent television series, The Last Governor, we got a fly-on-the-wall insight into the last 5 years of Hong Kong before being returned to Chinese rule. I expected the talks to be sophisticated, high-level discussions, but you could be forgiven for thinking that two ancient civilizations were no more than maverick states. Attitudes were frequently implacable, and it was often a case of them and us. And the workplace can be the same. Breakdowns occur between those in authority and those under authority. A recent survey showed that managers spend 25% of their time settling disputes. Our Christian faith affects our personalities, relationships, our marriages, what we say and do, and our values. Now, some may argue that to base a sermon on masters and slaves in the late 20th century is irrelevant to a contemporary society. After all, legalized slavery is a thing of the past, thanks to William Wilberforce and others of the 18th century. These verses, however, offer us codes of conduct to enhance our working relationships, whether we be in authority or under authority. And although slavery is illegal today, there are some employers who do indeed make slaves of their employees. My boss and I made a presentation to the board of directors of a large company just a few weeks ago. In the lead up to the presentation, our link man was continually harassed by his boss. He kept him at his desk until late every evening and constantly was on the phone to him at weekends. This man has a 2-hour journey to and from work every day. He lives in perpetual fear, and it's unmistakable. His boss relishes every minute of it. I'd like us to look at these verses in three parts. First, what do these verses tell us about our work relationships? Second, to look at some possible solutions to common problems. And third, to ensure we receive the promise from God. First then, what do these verses tell us about our work relationships? Paul speaks to two groups of people, those under authority, covered in verses 5 to 8, and second, those in authority, in verse 9. First then, those under authority. Let me read again verses 5 to 8. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters, with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart, as to Christ, not in the way of eye service, as men pleases, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will, as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same again from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. Well, Paul outlines four codes of conduct, followed by a promise from God. And you may like to follow these verses with me on page 184. The first code of conduct is found in verse 5. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters. Or put another way, employees, be obedient to your employers. Obedience here doesn't imply subservience. Rather, it means being respectful and loyal. A Christian man working in insurance faced a question of obedience. He was dealing with an annual commercial premium due for payment. The previous year's premium was £4,000, but the renewal cost had gone up to about £5,000. Well, as you can imagine, the client let off a fair head of steam. Later, the man discovered the same cover was available with a different underwriter for £2,000, a saving of £3,000. He discussed this with his boss, and the boss's answer went something like this. Tell the customer we've managed to secure his premium at the same rate as last year. He'll be happy, and we'll earn an additional £2,000. The question the insurance man immediately asked his boss was, is that right? He wanted to be obedient to his boss, but he also knew he could pass on considerable cost savings to his client. However, it got to the point where further discussion might have put his livelihood at risk. But he had made his point. The second code of conduct is also in verse 5. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart as to Christ. Singleness of heart meaning purity of heart. In other words, our heart should be in our work in the same way that our heart belongs to Jesus Christ. There's often a buzz being around people who genuinely enjoy their work, isn't there? The third code is found in verse 6. Not in the way of eye service, as men pleases. Insincerity is no more than false affection, is it? It's what my mother calls cupboard love. Paul says, don't be like this. Be sincere. Don't pretend obedience when you mean to disobey. Serve your employer well, not just when he or she is with you. In a nutshell, we should serve our employer faithfully. A few years ago, it came to my notice that one of my managers was having an affair with one of our female merchandisers. The affair had been clandestine for a few weeks, but then, inevitably, they were found out. Do you know, I was amazed at the enjoyment factor. People loved to talk about it, and it was fast becoming a major distraction to the business. So I counseled a few people. Why spoil their fun? What's up, Rog? Jealous? It's probably just a fling. It'll soon fizzle out. But it didn't, and so I went to speak with the manager. I said much that you'd expect. What about your family? What about all the fun at your expense? What about the effect on the business? But I discovered later that the most telling comment I made was this. Haven't you taken advantage of and undermined your position of responsibility as manager with your subordinate? The fourth code of conduct is in verse 7. Rendering service with a good will, as to the Lord and not to men. In the last governor, goodwill was frequently non-existent. The feel-good factor just simply wasn't there. But Paul advises us to offer goodwill in the same way that we offer it to God. When a business is sold, a particularly valuable part of the sale is the goodwill of that business. In fact, there are times when all you can sell in a business is the goodwill, and that can be worth a premium. A couple of years ago, while working for Andrew Brownsword, Jean had a cancer scare followed by major surgery. During the recuperation, Jean came to the conclusion that in future she wouldn't be able to manage the rigours of day-to-day selling, which involved driving around 35,000 miles a year. She decided to be open about this at her yearly appraisal, and indeed was asked at that meeting, "How do you see your job developing?" Well, Jean told them about her decision, and her boss was very understanding. First, she thanked Jean for all her hard work, and then agreed to a leaving date well in advance of the standard 1 month's notice. It really was a good example of joint cooperation and of goodwill prevailing. And of course, God kept taking complete control of the situation. So the four codes of conduct are obedience, singleness of heart, sincerity, and goodwill. And the promise from God is found in verse 8. "Knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same again from the Lord, whether he is slave or free." God will reward even the meanest task carried out in the spirit of duty, because doing so glorifies God. As Christians, we serve a greater master. Whatever we put in, God gives back. Conversely, the Christian who causes disruption in the workplace cannot expect the promise of God. And so, what about those in authority? A curate living in the north of England had a particularly difficult relation in his first curacy. At last, it was time to leave. No more would he have to suffer the slings and arrows of this obstinate vicar. He came to preach his last sermon, stood up in the pulpit and said with a smile on his face, "My text is from Genesis. Abide here with the ass and I will go yonder." You could be forgiven for thinking that Paul's attention is somewhat weighted in these verses. Four verses are spoken directly to the employee, with just one verse spoken to the employer. But look at the first five words of verse 9. "Masters, do the same to them." All the codes of conduct that apply to the employee apply to the employer as well. But Paul doesn't leave this just as a quid pro quo statement, does he? He adds a further code of conduct, especially for the employer. Look at verse 9. "Masters, do the same to them." That includes the four codes. "And forbear threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him." The employer should not threaten the workforce. Well, I imagine some of you will be thinking, if only my employer would adhere to that. But Paul is clear, tyrannical and overbearing behaviour should never be used. And Paul explains why in verse 9. "Because we are all fellow servants, and there is no difference between us in the eyes of God." I worked for 9 years of my earlier life in a military band. We had a bandmaster who was particularly oppressive. He enjoyed his position of rank and often misused it. I remember one day especially, our sergeant's wife had a miscarriage and lost her baby. The sergeant asked for some compassionate leave. The bandmaster's reply was as follows: "This has come at a most inconvenient time." I'll never forget those words. A human life had expired, but to the bandmaster, it was no more than an inconvenience. And so, second, Let's look at some possible solution, at a possible solution to some of these relationship problems at work. Mrs. Ponsonby Smythe was very fussy. She was always meticulous about everything she bought. One day at the fishmonger's, elbowing her way to the front of the queue, she looked hard and long at the lobsters. She prodded one, which immediately started to crawl away. "They're beautiful lobsters, ma'am," said the fishmonger. "As you can see, they're still alive." "I can see that," said Mrs. Ponsonby Smythe. "But are they fresh?" We're all so different, aren't we? Let's first remind ourselves of the three main behavioural types. Broadly speaking, most of us are either aggressive, passive, or assertive. If psychometric testing were available in first century Palestine, I'd love to have seen the personality profile for Jesus. He was aggressive in the marketplace of the coin changers. He was often passive in the sense that he submitted to his father's will, and no one could doubt the assertiveness of his teaching. That would have confounded a few personnel managers today, wouldn't it? There's a northern expression that says, "There's nowt as queer as folk." There are two ladies in church who couldn't see eye to eye. One Christmas, against her better judgment, one of the ladies decided to send a Christmas card. And she wrote in it these words: "To live above with saints we love, oh, that will be a glory. To live below with saints we know, well, that's a different story." So what possible solution is there? Well, as Paul said last week, Paul Bishop that is, we can only pass on the limits of our own experience, and so please accept these within those limitations. In the workplace, disagreement quickly leads to anger, and many of us find it difficult to deal with. Often, we have to adapt to changing situations. But here's a simple 5-point plan that I've found useful. It can help alleviate difficulties at work, or indeed wherever relationship problems arise. It works like this. 1, begin with a positive comment. 2, outline the current situation. 3, make your known your feelings. 4, suggest a positive change. And 5, indicate the benefits of those change. Let me give you a few examples. You find yourself angry at a situation that has built up over a period of time. You're afraid to deal with the problem for fear of painful confrontation. On the basis of the 5-point plan, you might say something like this. In this first example, I'll indicate where the 5 points arise. "I really do appreciate working with you." That's the positive comment. "But I would like to talk to you about something," that's the current position, "that's bothering me." That's your feelings. "I have a suggestion," that's the positive change, "that could help us work more closely together." And that's the benefit of the change. I know that this is put very simply, and of course there will often be much more dialogue involved in the technique. Here's another. You feel you're unappreciated, and your boss never gives you any recognition. The same approach can be used. "I like my job very much, but I don't always feel happy because you seem to be continually criticising me. It's good to be appreciated, and I think I do my job well. I feel positive that it would benefit both of us if we could talk this through." And one final example. You get a new boss who hasn't been in authority before. Gosh, we've all had them, haven't we? And it goes to his or her head. Authority is taken away from you and you feel under siege. You might handle it something like this. "You must be very pleased with your promotion. Unfortunately, it's left me feeling that I've been demoted, and that really upsets me. I'm sure I could prove to you that I am very capable, and that this would save so much of your time to do the rest of your work. Can we chat about this soon?" Let me emphasize again, these are only guidelines. You can use this technique, though, in most situations. But often we have to work things out over a long period of time. And sometimes we may not succeed. But then, at least we can say we have tried. There are increasing numbers of cases coming before industrial tribunals because of sexual harassment. Let me say briefly, you don't have to put up with it. It's often an abuse of power, and it's used by men and women who take particular pleasure in embarrassing younger people. You can try to alleviate the situation. Make it clear you don't accept that kind of behaviour. Tell someone you trust exactly what was said or done. Keep a written record of dates and times and who was present. And if it continues, tell the offender the action you have taken. And if this doesn't work, send that report in writing to somebody in authority. I like the story of the lady who was sitting with a board meeting and felt a hand on her knee. She turned to the man beside her, lifted his arm up, and said in a voice loud enough for everyone to hear, "I believe this is yours. Do please keep it to yourself." And so lastly, how can we Christians ensure we receive the promise from God? An elderly lady was walking across Central Park carrying a violin. She noticed a man coming towards her, who she didn't recognise, who happened to be Leonard Bernstein. "Can you tell me how I can get to Carnegie Hall?" she asked. Leonard Bernstein looked at her, then looked at her violin and replied, "Practice, ma'am, practice." And that's the secret, isn't it? We need to look at these codes in the light of our own motives and practice. In 1 John 4, it says, "If anyone says, 'I love God,' yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, cannot love God, whom he has not seen. And he has given us this command, whoever loves God must also love his brother." Are we patient? Are we forbearing? Can we always genuinely say, "I love my brother"? Well, I confess, it's not always easy. There's one person I don't look forward to speaking to, particularly on the phone. He tells me about his backache, toothache, his wife's varicose veins, the pollen count, and the mildew on his roses. It takes about 20 minutes before we actually talk about the business. But actually, he's very good at his job. Sometimes it's difficult to love my brother, but that's what we're called to do, isn't it? In Matthew 5:23, we read, "Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift." The teaching is simple and direct. Go and be reconciled. Don't delay. And whatever our problems, Jesus is with us. He will give us the courage to address difficult situations. Our work colleagues should know we're Christians. It should be seen in the caring people we are. In Ephesians 4, Paul says, "I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace." We are messengers of Jesus in the workplace. We need to be on our guard to ensure that our actions, attitudes, and motives are within God's will. We can be as guilty as anyone else of simply wanting our own way. And there's one crucial question we need to ask of ourselves before we can be assured of the promise of God. Is our job an occupation or an obsession? Don't misunderstand me. I'm not undermining the importance of our professional duties. What I'm asking is, do our jobs take priority over our families? Is most of our time consumed by our work? Are we workaholics? Is our spiritual life submerged because of our work? For many years, I lived in what I thought was the excitement of the fast lane. Then I realized I needed to make a proper commitment to God, where God was genuinely the managing director of my life. And God's beginning to show me what I call the wider picture, that this life is a minute fraction of an eternity with God. I've begun to understand that my life has to be lived within that context. My spiritual life had to be infinitely more important than my profession. Well, I wonder if the sidesman would like to hand out the cards for me, please. Work has its proper place in our lives. And as we obey these codes of conduct, we open a credit account with God. Let me conclude with what must be a first. I'd like to issue all of you with a credit card. It's a credit card that's worth more in the long term than any other credit card in existence. It offers you and me a reminder that when we try to live within these codes, we receive continued credit in our account with God. And if you'd like a copy of the 5-point plan, please ask the sidesman for one as you leave. May God continue to bless all we do in our place of work. Amen.